What's up, guys? This is Mike, no use for a last name, coming at you for the October Patreon prize pack, which is featuring the 1791 Everyday Carry tool organizer set. I have a random name generator here that we're going to spin, and we'll see who wins for October. And there it is. Chris Wrigley, you have won the October Patreon prize pack. Again, that is thanks to 1791 Everyday Carry. So congratulations to you, and we appreciate everybody that supports us and appreciate everybody that supports Digital 410. Thanks.
Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we have a special one-on-one interview today. We're going back old school. Jeff and Dennis will not be joining us this week. But we're breaking new ground. We actually have the first ever fellow of the Royal Historical Society. Author Simon Parkin joins us today to discuss his great book, The Forbidden Garden. We've talked in the past that we don't get enough content on here talking about the Eastern Front, Italy, North Africa campaigns. And, well, we're going to break that down a little bit because now we're going to talk about the siege of Leningrad. But more importantly, something that I learned from this book, who would ever thought that Russian scientists, Russian botanists were the first group to decide to come up with the idea of the importance of having a seed bank? Prior to this group of botanists, there was no organized, centralized deposit for seeds to help the attempt, which, crazily, 80 years later, some of these arguments still sound very, very similar to what happened back then as far as starvation, gene splicing, and all the things that botanists get into. But before we get into the book, The Forbidden Garden by Simon Parkin. Simon, give us a history of you. Where were you born? How did you get into this crazy world that we love in history so much?
Well, firstly, yeah, thanks so much for having me on your show. I was born in South London, here in the UK, which is where I live now. I currently live outside of London, about an hour on the south coast near Brighton, for any of your listeners who know England at all. I'm a journalist by background. I started out as a freelancer, mainly sort of writing tech journalism and covering that kind of industry. And then with time, I moved into more long form journalism, writing longer features, reported stuff, going to places all around the world and interviewing people, tracking down stories, and getting into, I suppose, working at those longer distances. And the way I got into writing about this particular period of history was I was working on a radio segment for the New Yorker Radio Hour. So I'm a contributing writer to the New Yorker and made some radio stuff for them as well. And I was interested in the field of war games, which I don't need to tell you, but just for anyone who isn't too clear on what that is, these are sort of games that are designed to help. It could be politicians, it could be military officers, strategists, whoever it is, but they will outplay potential scenarios in order to see what kind of outcomes might happen, be it in a battle, be it in a, you know, a political event. It could be anything really that you can think of where there are multiple potential outcomes. So I was interested in this world and I went along to an army base here in the UK in Shrivenham, where a retired major there runs lots of war games here in the UK and designs them as well. And he's run war games at the Pentagon here in Whitehall and to all around the world. And I sat in on a game, and actually each of the players in this game had the role of a different nation. And it was just at the time after Sergei Skripal, the former Russian spy, there was an attempted murder on him here in the UK. And our prime minister at the time, Theresa May, had expelled a load of Russian diplomats. And so they were playing a war game to kind of see what the outcomes of this might be, what might Russia's response be, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it was a playful thing, but they were going through that so I could just sit in as a fly on the wall. And I was interviewing Major Tom afterwards, who was a designer of this game. And I said to him, have you got any examples of where things discovered in war games have proven useful in the real world? And firstly, he gave the example of the red telephone from the Cold War in the White House that I'm sure people are familiar with, which is a direct line to the Kremlin. And the idea being that on the eve of nuclear warfare, it would make sense for the leader of the United States to be able to have direct contact without having to go through diplomatic channels. And he said that idea came out of a war game that was being played in the 1960s. And then he gave an example of a war game that was played during the Second World War to help Britain understand why the U-boats were proving so successful in the Battle of the Atlantic, and how through this war game, which had been designed by a naval captain and a group of young women in the Wrens, how this had revolutionized the naval tactics in the Battle of the Atlantic. And so that, you know, pricked my ears up and sounded like War, which was a game of birds and wolves. And so, yeah, once you've done one book of that era, I suppose it becomes easier to do another. And so this book we're talking about today, The Forbidden Garden, is my third book from the 1940s.
Now, growing up in the United Kingdom, even in the modern era, do you find that because of where you guys are located and the amount of history that your country has partaken in, do you find that your citizens have more of an inherent interest in history, whether it's World War I, World War II, just in general, because it's in your blood? Because, for example, here in America, one of the things living historians, you know, we're trying to do is to keep the new generation and let people know about the history and this particular topic, the history of World War II, because, yes, Lindley's, we had a lot of our troops over there, but with the exception of maybe one or two barrage balloons that landed on our continent, and then what happened in Pearl Harbor, our society was disconnected greatly as far as the civilian aspect of it goes. And so when you don't have bombs here, when you don't walk down your city in 2024 on a Saturday and still see bullet holes in old masonry, there's a huge disconnect. Whereas, you know, the United Kingdom, your all's history is so ingrained in history. And the fact that you can still walk around and see, here's fences that are made out of old first aid carriers from World War One. World War Two. Here's battle scars from World War One. Do you find that just your populace in a whole still kind of has more of a historical interest ingrained in them?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Yes, and certainly for people of my generation, our sort of grandparents told us about their memories from the Second World War. Absolutely. You know, whether that was being involved in combat or just being, you know, in my grandmother's case, being at home, being on the home front and, you know, being subject to rationing and all of those other things that greatly affected that generation. So, and my father's generation grew up, of course, with all of the Second World War films that were coming out of Hollywood, which had a huge cultural impact on the way in which we viewed that conflict, and the shadow of which just looms so heavily. Even today, I would say, perhaps we're at a turning point now where my children are now sufficiently distant, perhaps, from that time, that things are now going to shift. And, you know, I think I can probably detect that World War II is still very much taught in our schools. But I think, yeah, there is now just that temporal distance that creates a slight, you know, more of a disconnect perhaps than I would have had when I was a teenager, when it was still so present. But yeah, you're right. The physicality and the idea that you can walk around London, which was blitzed, and you can still see, you know, the scars of that in many of our towns and cities. So that, yeah, the past is very present here, I suppose, in a way. You know, the particularly with the Second World War conflict, is not quite the same in where you live.
How did the idea of the subject matter of the Forbidden Garden, how did you land on this particular subject? Because it's not a simple subject, which we'll get into. This book, and I want to get this out of the way now for those, you know, who may not listen to the entire interview at first sitting because people listen to them while traveling. The Forbidden Garden is not just a book about botanists in Leningrad. The amount of history research, I mean, you go into the hierarchy, the different types of seeds, the where they're indigenous to, the locations they're picked up at. You go into the art society, history of art, during the evacuation period, what artist stuff was taken from certain museums, the struggles that after the Civil War, that the Plant Institute, as it becomes known, the struggles they are having with losing funding because other scientific groups are kind of sabotaging them, because they're all in this communist society, you had limited resources, and when you have a quote-unquote scientific budget that's spread out amongst all group of scientists, it's kind of perfect example. You worked in radio. I'm sure I worked in radio for 6 years. I'm sure it's similar over there, and it says here, it's dog eat dog, right? This radio show needs access to this budget. You know, this producer wants this. This intern would love to have the producer's job. The van driver would love to have the intern's job. Everything is dog eat dog, and there's a lot of nepotism. And they were dealing with that there in Leningrad, too. It's like, we're losing funding because we're getting sabotaged by the art department, or this group here doesn't believe in what we're doing. And then you have the entire society saying, why are we wasting money on sending these researchers out on, you know, they say they're out collecting seeds, but they're just wanting to get a vacation and get out of here a while. So this book is not just a simple story of some botanist and trying to survive a siege. You go deep in this thing. How did this subject matter pop into your mind? How did you decide on this book? And then we'll get into it. How do you go about researching this?
Well, you know, just to zoom right out, I suppose, I think as an author of narrative nonfiction, I'm looking for just a compelling story, first and foremost, just in its most simple terms, just like a human story of where there's conflict and courage and heroism and all of that. And the detail comes later. And for me, you know, the simple story here is during the siege of Leningrad, which is the longest siege of any city that we know of in history, there was the world's first seed bank in the middle of the city. And the botanists who work there are faced with this terrible decision. As the city citizens around them start to starve to death because no food is coming into Leningrad, and they themselves are starting to starve to death, they're surrounded by 250,000 seeds and plants, things that they could have eaten that could have sustained their lives and the lives of people around them. So they have this choice. Do we eat the seeds and distribute them to the people who are dying? And in doing so, destroy this collection that we've spent 20, 30 years amassing? Or do we protect this seed in the interests of science? And as a result, people will die, including some of us. And so in that very simple sort of, you know, paragraph pitch, I suppose, there's like enough there that you go, oh, I want to know what they decided. That's an interesting story. And then once you've got that hook, and I'm talking about for myself, just as someone who's looking for a project, am I going to give 3 years of my life to researching this thing and writing it? You know, there's enough of a hook there. And then it's a case of, you know, very practically seeing what other books have been published about this. Is there like, can I add to the history in a meaningful way? Because I want to try and do that as well as telling a good story. So that's really like how I decided upon the project. In terms of like how I first heard about it, I was reading a newspaper article about a land dispute in the suburbs of Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg. There was a developer wanted to build some apartments on this a piece of land that has lots of very rare trees that were planted by the botanists in the 1920s and 1930s. And so there was outcry, not only in Russia, but around the world from botanists saying, you can't do this. You can't build apartments on this land. It's historically significant. It's scientifically significant. And in the piece, it just had two lines basically describing what I just said to you there about the siege and what the botanists had to decide. And that's just what piqued my interest and sent me off down the path to find out everything I could about the subject. And really my first port of call was to write to the seed bank, which is still there in the same building that really? It was in the 1940s. Yeah. So I wrote to the archivist there and just said, look, you know, this is who I am. I write books. I'm interested in this story. Is there any chance you would let me visit and look at your archive? And that was the start of it, really. And then you kind of build out from there and try to find the characters that you want to highlight and find out about their stories. And then the broader stuff you were talking about, the politics of the era, the politics, how that's affecting scientists and the work that they're just trying to do. And of course, that was very close to the That was a huge consideration in Stalinist Soviet Union. Of course, politics is affecting everything, even people who really aren't politically interested. You know, they just want to do their scientific work. But of course, you can't do that in a vacuum. You're subject to all of these other forces. So it's just sort of educating me about those myself about those things, doing lots of reading. And then what I really wanted to try and do was tell the story of the botanists almost week by week through the siege. And that requires, you know, then trying to find out what's happening in outside the plant institute in the city and starting to piece it together as a puzzle, really.
You know, you said an interesting keyword there, which is in a vacuum, which ironically, scientists and even computer technicians nowadays, because that's what I do, I'm an IT guy, we work in a vacuum. You know, our work is in a, often for case of scientists, in a sterile scientific environment. A lot of times, right. no sunlight coming through, just head down in your work. And so for someone to be in an industry who typically works in a vacuum, that's why a lot of these scientific groups work on the same campus together, right? They want to be around like-minded people that they can bounce ideas off of and to gain influence and knowledge from other people. But even as a whole, they're still kind of working in a vacuum. And so the irony is that they got to remove themselves from that vacuum. And to be a young scientist whose desire and goal is to collect seeds, their end goal, because of what Russia and the Russian populace survived during their civil war, as you so pointed out in the book, going into the siege of Leningrad, German armies cutting off supplies, you had a large populace of the people who lived there who already survived starvation during the Civil War.
Yes.
And so a lot of the young botanists, their core goal, collecting step number one, but at the end of the day, they're trying to find the most rugged seed that you can grow damn near anywhere, regardless of, you know, we can find these seeds, we can categorize them, and then we can distribute seeds to certain parts of the world that we know that this seed will have a higher likelihood to produce a yield to feed their populace. So their goal was to try to figure out the best way to solve world hunger. And then, as you said, here they are sitting on all the seeds that they could have planted 6 months ago or start planting now, not knowing how long the siege is going to be. And unlike other collections, art has an inherent value, but that inherent value is only if you're around in 20 years to enjoy it. Gold has an inherent value. That inherent value is, once again, if you're alive next week to enjoy it. Food and seed's a little different because it needs a time to grow. But once again, you have a food source. Out of all those things, if you're in a cutoff city and supplies are dwindling, are people going to be more likely to rob you for your gold, your art, or your food? And so, like you said, they had a very huge decision to make. And I guess to do justice for our audience, we're skipping around here a little bit. Let's give the audience your elevator pitch, the breakdown of what the book, The Forbidden Garden, is, what it's about. And obviously, we don't want to give too much away, but give them the elevator pitch, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, so the story is about the Plant Institute, the world's first seed bank, formal seed bank, that had around 250,000 seeds and plants in it. It's situated in the middle of Leningrad, the city now known as St. Petersburg, on St. Isaac Square, which is very close to the very famous Hermitage Museum, which is full of priceless bits of artworks. And tell the story of the seed bank's founder, Nikolai Vavilov, who was this very sort of inspirational figure, well loved by the botanists he worked with. And he was an explorer as much as he was a scientist, and had, as you say, this plan to travel around the world, seek out rare wild plants, particularly crops like wheat and rye and, you know, all of that kind of thing, maize, flax. And his theory was that there might be varieties of, say, wheat growing high in the mountains that have genetic properties that could be useful to farmers. So, you know, maybe they can withstand low temperatures, or they are disease resistant. And perhaps these, you know, varieties had just been overlooked by farmers hundreds of years earlier when they were, you know, figuring out what crops they were going to grow. So he said, let's go find all of these plants, bring them back to Russia where we can study them, and potentially, you know, find some of these traits and crossbreed them to create you know, seeds that have a higher yield. This is the stuff that scientists do now, farmers do now. You know, it was ahead of its time, but it's very familiar. It's how we all get to eat every day is because of this kind of work, right? But at the time, it was pretty forward thinking. And the Vavilov's theories were sort of in conflict with the communist regime, with Stalin, and he came not from peasant stock but from a well-to-do family, and so he finds himself at odds with the Stalin regime. And there's a rival botanist called Trofim Lysenko who holds different theories with communist ideology, and so Lysenko is promoted up the ranks to become the main sort of botanist in Soviet Russia, while Vavilov is sidelined. And actually Vavilov is out in the summer of 1940 collecting seeds on a mountainside with some of his botanists when a black car pulls up and four shady-looking characters climb out and they say, "Vavilov, you're needed in Moscow with us. Get into the car, come with us. It's urgent business." Vavilov gets into the car, but of course he's not required on urgent business. The four men are from the NKVD, the precursor to the KGB, and he's being arrested. And he then undergoes around 900 hours of interrogation, you know, just an amount of physical deprivation and intense questioning that many of us can't even imagine. And through that, his interrogators extract false confession. And he says that he was spying for the British on all of these overseas trips. True, he didn't do that. But he was, I think, trying to spare his colleagues from a similar fate. So Vavilov is tried, sentenced to death. And when the siege of Leningrad begins in the late summer of 1941, the botanists in the city are without their leader. And they don't know how quickly the German army is advancing. They sort of think perhaps we should try and get our seeds out of the city to safekeeping, which is something that the Hermitage Museum across the square is doing. And the story really begins in earnest when the German troops arrive in the suburbs around Leningrad and the siege begins and the botanists have to decide what they're going to do for the next 900 days almost.
And for those just sitting at home thinking, well, how hard is it to evacuate a suitcase full of seeds? No, it was, I think you said the book was the equivalent of an adult. The amount of seeds they had was the weight of an adult elephant. Now, seeds are small and light, so you got to take the average size of a seed, compound it to get to that.
I think it was 120 tons they had of plant matter. So it was a considerable amount, yeah. It all was sorted. And so it wasn't just a case of let's just chuck everything into a huge bag or something. You know, everything was had to be very carefully, scientifically kept categorized. And, so if there was going to be an evacuation attempt, it wasn't going to be straightforward. And in fact, they do, just before the siege begins, they get word that they've been given by the city's government two train carriages on a train that's due to leave the city. And so they do try, they box up a small portion of the collection and put it on the train. And some of the scientists get on the train with other leaders of institutions around the city. But the train reaches the town of Magar, MGA, that is, which was the last final route out of Leningrad before the siege finishes. And just before the train can get through, the Germans take that town. And so the train has to go back to the city. So the evacuation fails, that attempt, yeah.
Well, this point will lead to my next question. But, you know, they go into the siege without a leader, as you mentioned previously. But more importantly, or more historically, I guess, the struggles they have is they live in a society where basically you don't exactly have private property. So it's not like they can get up and move this stuff. The collection was funded by city finances. This stuff is technically owned by the government. They have to have permission to move the stuff. And so they've been waiting around. And though this stuff is very, very important to them, and as a whole, very important to the survival of humanity, if you're looking at it that way, the higher ups are more concerned about the financial stuff. You know, we got to get rid of the gold. We got to move the gold. We got to move the art, and we got to move the kids. That's the three things that are going to help this society survive. You're like, well, you need food too, but they're not thinking that way. So all the resources primarily, let's get the kids out. Let's get the high end art. Let's get the gold out. and then we'll worry about these weird scientists and their envelopes of seeds. And which leads to my next question. As an author, how do you juggle this? In storytelling, you usually have the good guys and the bad guy. Oftentimes, maybe there's one or two good guys. You know, you have a group of good guys and there's a protagonist. But in this setting, this historical setting, you have the botanists, we'll call the good guys. And then you have the Germans, obviously. They're precision on Leningrad. They're the bad guys, but you got the Stalinists. You got this society that they've lost control. You have the other scientists trying to sabotage them to get their funding. You have the paranoia that's going on in the city. Are these guys actually collecting food? Are they spies for the United Kingdom? And so it seems like you have a group of good guys and a whole swath of bad guys. How do you take all that and cohesively write a story trying to maintain the basis of good story writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the benefit of working in the format of a book is you can have more of that complexity and nuance and really build out some of the, you know, the shades of grey that are in every historical story, if we're honest. You know, it's not to be trusted if you just have very clear good guys and bad guys, as you put it. You know, obviously, if you're making a movie, then you have to make things simpler and make it easier for an audience to understand what's going on. But here, at least, I think you can get into some of those complexities. And this is a very complex story, as you say, because even within the seed bank itself, where, you know, before the siege begins, there's around 100 staff members and you've got students. And, you know, there were disputes there over people who were loyal to Vavilov, the founder. And then there were people who distrusted him and who were loyal to Lysenko. And so even just within the building, you've got shades of grey and complexity and political complication, I suppose. For me, the scientists who work at the seed bank are being assaulted from both sides here. They've got the German army who are advancing on the city, who want to take Leningrad. This is a very specific military goal of Hitler. He gives the order to his troops, you're not to advance on Moscow until then. And the reason for this is because Leningrad is, you know, it's the city where Lenin came from. It's the hero, as it were, of Bolshevism. It's where revolution came out of. It's also a, you know, pretty diverse artistic thinking city, and so they, you know, it there's lots of symbolic value for Hitler to and the Nazis to take out Leningrad. So the botanists are tied up in that. In addition, you know, something I get into the book a bit later is there are Nazi botanists who are aware of the collection and of the seed bank's work and who want to take it themselves and take it back to Austria and Germany to do their own experiments and continue the work that Vavilov did, except for the benefit of the German people. So you've got them on one side, and then, like you say, on the other side, you've got Stalin, who is and his regime, who are suspicious of the Plant Institute, of its endeavors, who are frustrated that they've given it lots of scientific funding that they're yet to really reap the rewards of. There keep being, as you said, these waves of famine across the Soviet Union. Vavilov gives Stalin an estimate that I think his experiments are going to take 8 or 9 years before mm-hmm. they start to really increase the yield of crops, and he wants much far
sure
being abandoned from the other side as well. So for me, you know, even though there's some squabbling happening in the sea, it is, like you say, they are being assaulted really from every side, and they have very few people fighting their corner at the beginning of the siege.
Well, as you pointed out in the book, this experiment, this collection took 20 years or so to produce, and they weren't just walking around Russia and Europe collecting these. They were world travelers at this point. And Vavilov, up to before the siege went down, his name started to get big. A lot of publications. Here he is traveling the United States, Africa, all around the world. So his name is building up in scientific circles. So it's not a surprise in any way, shape, and or form that a group of botanists in Germany would know about him in the seed bank, because there's been all sorts of articles, publications. As you pointed out, his loyalty to Leningrad and to the seed bank was so he had more than plenty of opportunities just not to return home from one of these trips to the United States or to London or to wherever, Australia. Him and his group traveled all around the world collecting these seeds. They could have easily just said, you know what? I like the weather and the politics here. I'm staying here. And he would have had plenty of supporters. You know, plenty of governments would have loved to have him and his group of botanists come work on their problems on their continent using their funding. But no, he always returned home, which is kind of the irony of, as you're saying, hours and hours of interrogation until you finally give up a false. You know, you hear that in other stories too. You know, there's a in the movie from Quentin Tarantino on Reservoir Dogs, he says, you know, you could beat him for 5 hours. He'll tell you he started the Chicago Fire. It doesn't make it so. And that's the risky run of high intense interrogation. After a while, a person will break and they will just start telling you whatever they think you want to hear to make the beating stop.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, that was specifically, he was interrogated by Lieutenant Cavart, and that was, you know, the interrogator understood his job was to extract a particular confession. He already knew the story that he wanted to pass on. He was just trying to get Vavilov to the point where he would collude in that fiction.
When it came to researching this book, you kind of preemptively answered one of my questions, is that the Institute is still around. They have historical documents. But when it came to building the timeline, building the story, building the conversation, did you find your ways to family members of those who were involved that survived, that maybe had old diaries around, old letters, old documentation? How much input did you actually have from family members or historical persons that had some sort of connection with those involved?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was certainly my plan when I embarked on this project. I've written two books, as I say, about this period before, and I've spoken in both of those cases. You know, the first thing I do is try and find family members and see if there are memoirs or unpublished diaries, whatever it is, because that's the gold stuff, the gold source material you want to start telling a story like this. So when I started working on this project, I hired a genealogist in Russia. And, you know, we began the work of trying to identify descendants of some of the people who worked at the seed bank. But of course, you know, as we were saying earlier, none of this work happens in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm writing this book in the current day, you know, even though it's a story from 100 years ago, you know, what's possible is subject to what's happening geopolitically today in the 2020s. And of course, with the wide-scale invasion of Ukraine, it made travel to Russia impossible for a British person, or if not impossible, then highly ill-advised. You know, I've worked as a journalist. I've reported on, neo-Nazi groups in Moscow as a journalist before, and so visited to the country. And so I'm no doubt on like some database as a result of that. So if I had been to travel there, it's, you know, it just would have been a highly risky thing to do, and, you know, not wise at all.
That didn't even occur to me, the location of the seed bank in modern times and how modern political and, well, let's be honest, warfare would affect travel. Not to mention, you're trying to track down documents, perhaps diaries or letters, written in a city that was surrounded and cut off, where there could have been all sorts of diaries and documentation. But when you're cold, once again, what's more important, heating your kids or that diary sitting in the corner that could, you know, at least help us start burning this kitchen table? So a lot of that stuff could have been turned into kindling a long time ago.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, the point is that I had to basically abandon the idea of tracking down family members because it just wasn't going to be possible. I was saved by the fact that this archivist who works at the seed bank today speaks, good English and was very eager to assist me. You know, I think she wanted this story to be more fully told than it has been in the past. And so she just went into the archives and started scanning everything that they had and sending it to me on secure channels. And that meant that I could then work to have those documents translated and could start piecing it together in that way. So that's sort of how this project was possible, even possible with current world events. And, you know, the other complicating factor is that, you know, it's not like the siege ends and the Second World War ends, and suddenly everyone is able to tell their story. Mm-hmm. You know, in the late 1940s, throughout the 1950s, there's still so much paranoia. There's, you know, it's very risky to start talking about, you know, how hard a time you had during the siege of Leningrad. There's still political reasons why the Soviet government doesn't want people necessarily telling those kind of stories. So it takes decades for people to start sharing their memories of what had happened during the siege of Leningrad. And even then, you know, you don't know how much they're self-censoring in order to not cause issues. So, you know, you're also, you know, as a sort of historian dealing with these sources, you've just got to take so much into account with what you're reading. It's not like, oh, you know, here's a paragraph that explains everything exactly how it was. You have to think, well, you know, if this was written in 1961, what's going on politically then, mm-hmm. that would have maybe have made the person writing this sort of write it in a particular way. So yeah, it's a very, you know, tricky, delicate thing to do, I think, trying to reconstruct a story. And I'm not saying I've done it perfectly, of course, but I'm just trying to explain some of the difficulties in trying to do this work.
How cool and unforeseen is it for you as the author, just because, as you were saying, that the female archivist over at the Plant Institute went into the archives and started scanning stuff that I'm going to assume hadn't previously been scanned. You almost, this book kind of has started almost a digital backup of their paper, the paper logs that they have had for all these years. And now you kind of, and I'm sure possibly they're still doing it as a way, hey, we need to start backing up this paper stuff and digitizing it so we can store it offsite in case, heaven forbid, a sprinkler goes off in this room and damages all this paper history. And so perhaps maybe you kind of inadvertently started the idea in the back of their minds that maybe we need to start digitizing this stuff and making a copy somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. And in fact, during the early months of the siege, the city is bombed. It's, you know, every night this German bombers coming over, dropping incendiary bombs. I think 106 bombs land on the Institute roof. So that gives you a good sense of just the sheer density of these bombs coming down throughout a 2 or 3 month period. And, you know, one of the things that they're eager to do is not only protect the seeds, but also protect all of their papers that they've amassed since the 1920s, which has got their research on it. It's got so much valuable scientific information. And so, yeah, you know, you've got this sort of combination of the archival richness of what's in the building with this sort of, like, you know, action movie stuff of botanists on the roof. You've got two of them up there with metallic pincers. When an incendiary bomb lands, they'll run over, grab it with the pincers, throw it into the courtyard where you've got more botanists at the bottom with piles of sand who are then shoveling it on to put out, you know, these things burn at like nearly 1,000 mm-hmm. degrees or something. So, you know, they're trying to like put them out as quickly as possible. And, yeah, it's just it's so interesting, isn't it? You've got exactly what you're talking about there, the desire to protect information with this, you know, almost, you know, very, like I say, action-y type things, physical aspect to the work as well.
Well, the other nice aspect of how you made this story more well-rounded and gave it a 360 view is you start talking about how the civilians, you know, most of them were sent to fortify the city, but here you have these botanists who kind of have a government job, so now their schedule split. Hey, you guys are going to work till noon, and then you're hopping on a train, you're heading out here, you're going to dig slit trenches, or you're going to do X, mm-hmm. Y, or Z. And so now they have to have the mind state to perform their highly skilled scientific functions, then go do manual labor all day, risk dying as if their train gets strafed by, you know, planes, and then come home exhausted, get a little bit of sleep, get up, rinse, and repeat, and how that would have an impact on one's, you know, desire to maintain the schedule. But another interesting fact is, you know, when it comes to art, per se, art museums, there's high protocol on how things are handled, how things are done, the care in which things are touched. But all that goes out the window when you have the German army come down on you and say, okay, these four things we're going to take very good care of. We're going to put in the rest of them, just yank that out of the frame as delicate as possible, but as fast as possible. And what is surprising, and it makes you wonder how much was lost. You start talking about statues, monuments, just being buried under dirt. Hey, we got to protect the stuff. We don't want the Germans to destroy it. We're going to go bury it. And as we hear all the time about the Battle of the Pacific, Peleliu, Tarawa, Marines were buried so quickly, and then documentation were hastily made, and then they had to exhume them to build airports. But here it is, 2024, we're still finding lost bodies buried. I wonder how much art was lost because the people who buried them died in a train, and their documentation where these particular things were buried. I wouldn't be surprised if all the way up until the 1980s, it, as always happens, oh, we're going to build an apartment here, let's break ground. Hey, is this a steel horse head? And it wouldn't be surprising to find that they're still finding high value statues and monuments and art buried all throughout St. Petersburg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, in the spring of 1942 as well, the ice on Lake Ladoga, which is the huge lake that borders one part of Leningrad, was sufficiently thick that they could make it into an evacuation road across the ice. And so some of the botanists get on these trucks that make a very perilous journey because, you know, there are German planes attacking them. There's, you know, traps being laid on the ice. There's also, you know, pockets where the ice is melting and it's dangerous there. So, and, you know, many, many lives were lost even while these trucks were going across the ice. And so, yeah, I'm sure there's still sort of wreckage and bodies from those evacuation attempts in the lake as well, even now.
Well, as you pointed out in the book, the daily German Weimar soldier, not the hardened SS Nazis, not the people who were, you know, raised in the Hitler youth camp, but your everyday inscripted soldier, your Weimar Republic soldier, they were just beat over the head. Harden your resolve, take no pity, show no pity, kill everything. There was no... This wasn't, hey, we're going to go take this town and use it for our, well, no, we're going to annihilate every living person, everything. We're going to blow this city off the map to the point where, as you pointed out, they sent out inaccurate information telling women, hey, wear white so our pilots won't hit you. No, they did that because they wanted to hit them so that they wouldn't reproduce. And, you know, just the intentional slaughter of civilians, women, children, and everything. It was just literally a no-holds-bar. Your survival, you know, to survive that type of, I don't even want to call it warfare, that type of atrocity. I mean, this wasn't German versus Russian soldiers. This was Germany versus everybody in that particular plot of land. And to survive that and to try to survive that, it's just, it's a steep climb.
Yeah. I mean, you're exactly right. And, you know, of course, the siege of Leningrad is one of the subjects at the Nuremberg trials for that exact reason, because of course when you besiege a city you are affecting not just combatants but everyone who lives in the city. And you know, the as you say, for an ordinary foot soldier who's not caught up in Nazi ideology but just happens to be in the German military or whatever, that's you know, psychologically you can imagine that's a difficult thing to participate in, of course. And you know, I think what I try and reflect in the book, and of course there are many, many, many books about the Siege of Leningrad that just tell the general, you know, what it was like to be in the city and how horrendous it was. But it comes home when you find out that, you know, later towards the winter of 1941, there's so little food and the rations that you're getting every day are not enough to sustain your life. You know, you're actively starving even while you're eating these small bits of ration. So families turn to, you know, eating their pets, and sometimes to make that easier, they trade their pets with those of their neighbors. But of course, you know, absolute heartbreaking, difficult decisions. And there are of course reports as well of cannibalism, in that first winter. One of the outcomes of that is that there's a huge explosion of vermin in the city because they've lost the cats and dogs that hunt them. And this specifically affects the botanists because the vermin can sense that there's a huge amount of food in this building. And so they start to assault the building. And so the botanists are faced with trying to hold back not only the German bombs, but also these attacks now by rats who are trying to get into the rooms and get to the collection. And so, you know, even while they're quite emaciated and starving from lack of food, they're pushing the collection into two storerooms. They take tin off the roof, tin sheets of tin, and they put it over the little seed containers, and then bolt the doors. And they institute a regime of checking the collection, but you can only go with, like, you know, sort of someone else, so you can be accountable for not eating the seeds or whatever. So, yeah, just the barbarity that a siege inspires in the day-to-day life of people who are subject to that siege is just very clear in the example of what happened to the botanists.
It's amazing if you think about how these guys and women, these botanists, were able to maintain their resolve and to maintain their desire and their willingness to keep in mind the importance of what they're trying to do. Because from the outside looking in, even when you're reading it, you kind of point out in this great story, and the Plant Institute is one thing, but they have all these satellite farms because that's what they're botanists. They need a place to plant stuff. They need a place to try these genetic gene splicing. And you tell this great story about how a handful of them's job it is, the tubers, hey, we need to go out, and we've been working on these multiple different types of potatoes that we've been planting, and we need to go try to save as many as we can. And here's a couple of Russian soldiers and some trucks. We're going to take you out to these satellite farms. You're going to collect as many of these potatoes as you can. And we're getting strafed and shot at by planes. And the Russians are like, why am I going to die for a truckload of potatoes? Because to them, they're just potatoes. You know, this is, you know, and to put it in modern day terms, you know, here in the United States, am I going to take a chance getting shot at to go get some Idaho potatoes from down at this farm? And so for the botanist to never lose the sight of how important it is, and not to all of a sudden think of, why am I doing this for a room full of potatoes or seeds or dandelions or wheat? I'm sure it helps when you're starving and you're thinking, okay, this is food. But, you know, at a certain point, you're like, I can, you know, maybe not be in so much danger if I'm not at this giant target being attacked by Germans, rats, and everything else. You know, I might have a better chance of surviving in this small apartment basement on the outskirts of town where I'm not so much of a target.
Yeah, you know, definitely. But I think one thing that the surviving botanists do say in their writing after the events is that having such a clear purpose, they feel, is one of the things that help them to survive. Because when you're starving in a siege situation, I think it's easy to lose hope. It's easy to, you know, you're already operating at a limited mental capacity because lack of nutrition affects your ability to think. So if every day you just have a very clear mission, which is, in their case, protect the seeds with my life, don't eat them. You know, they are the work of the last 20 years. It's your colleagues' work. By this point, some of the botanists are either starving to death or have died at the front or have died in bomb explosions. And so you've got that added responsibility of, oh, am I going to betray their, you know, sacrifice by eating these samples? No, I'm not going to do that, of course. I'm going to protect them with a similar degree of courage. And so just having that very simple task every day, certainly in the words of the botanist, is something that helps them to survive, ironically, I think. But, you know, having said that, you know, we should say that you know, many of the botanists do pay the ultimate price for this decision that they make. On Christmas Day 1941, Dr. Ivanov, who by that point is looking after the collection and looking after the building, goes into the room of one of his colleagues, Alex Shuchkin, who's an expert in ground nuts, and sees him at his desk, tries to rouse him, and he doesn't look up, so goes over and shakes him. And Ivanov realizes Shuchkin has died, and as he's shaking him, a packet of almonds spills out of his hands onto the desk, and it's clear that Shuchkin had been cataloguing these nuts, you know, at the moment that he dies, which I think is just, you know, the clearest indication of the decision, you know, the scale of the decision that they were making here. And 19 of the botanists starved to death while preserving the collection. So, you know, there are survivors, but in some ways the story is a tragedy, of course.
Now, during my research, I went over to your website simonparkin.com/books. And I see the paragraph for the Forbidden Garden of Leningrad. The name is slightly different and the cover is slightly different. Do you find when publishing books for worldwide consumption that you have sometimes alternative covers and even alternative titles to better move product in different environments? Or was that just the early stage book cover on your website?
No, yeah, that is true. I mean, there's always a different cover. Tastes in North America are very different to tastes here in the UK with book covers. I have a different publisher in the States than I do in the UK. And so they have their own separate teams that go and make their covers and get the product, you know, as it were, ready for that particular audience. And I think in America, my title was always The Forbidden Garden of Leningrad. But for the States, I think there was a sort of desire to try to get, you know, obviously people who care a lot about the Second World War and who are military history enthusiasts are going to be interested regardless. But I think they wanted to try and broaden the book out so maybe a more general audience might be inspired to pick it up, and perhaps losing the of Leningrad makes it a little more approachable for people who aren't like you and I and very interested in this.
Yeah, the American book cover is a lot more ominous too. You know, you got the beautiful building and then the garden in the front, whereas the other cover has some lady sitting in a pile of rubble, you know, thinking about what they went through with, you know, different varieties of plants and botany on the cover. So you had completely different cover as well.
Yeah.
Before we wrap things up, interestingly enough, you know, I see one of your first books, Death by Video Games.
Yeah.
Now, I'm 46 years old. I've been around since Super Nintendo, Nintendo 64. I wasted a good portion of my early 30s just playing Call of Duty for 8 hours a day until 12 hours a day on the weekends, until the point I got carpal tunnel syndrome between that and playing typing all day, the point where I just had to stop playing Xbox altogether. My daughter's in there 24 hours a day playing. I know it doesn't have to do with World War II, but I'm interested real quick. With that book, Death by Video Games, how did that subject matter come to you, and were you surprised by some of the stories you were told by the people you interviewed for that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I said right at the start, I started out as a journalist covering tech, and, you know, I'm interested in video games and the industry, and I'm a fan of games and believe in the medium. And, you know, of course, it's got risks as well, as you describe, and they can be very compelling, and but perhaps no more so than like a Netflix binge. Sure. Or whatever. But anyway, this, so the book, you know, it's obviously quite a negative title, Death by Video Game. And it is about these cases in South Korea and China where people typically would go to an internet cafe and play a game for 3 days straight and then die at the desks. And so, yeah, it's an investigation of some of those cases, but also more broadly, just looking at what are the things that are specific to video games that get people playing, you know, for so long. So it's even though it's a more negative title, it is a celebration, I think, in some ways, of the medium. Yeah, well, but very different to this book we're talking about today. Yeah.
Well, and we can't, as you know, people in this particular subject matter, World War II, we cannot overlook the importance. Even though some of the new modern version, when it comes to the multiplayer, the authenticity goes out the window. But when you look at the single player, the authenticity is there. But every time a World War II based theme video game comes out, or even a TV series, it does help a lot to get the young kids interested. You know, they might, if they are flipping through YouTube or back, I mean, before everything was streaming, you know, when we still had cable, people, you know, when the early Call of Duties came out, kids flipping through channels and they see a quick shot of, you know, D-Day or whatever, they might stop and say, oh, that's from Call of Duty. And then all of a sudden now their that interest is there. And it's, and so that definitely helps us there. But yeah, so no, I saw that title and I was like, oh, that's pretty interesting. You know, the other thing about, and one of the things they're doing now with video games, especially multiplayer stuff. And we kind of saw this with the original Warzone and, the one that Fortnite was the secondary version of, the first
PUBG.
And that was, hey, we'll give away the root game for free.
Yeah.
And just start nickel and diming people. And that even goes down to, I just recently found out someone I know spends an average of $200 a month on Candy Crush. Not that they're spending, just by, let me pay 10 cents for an extra move. And that 10 cent, that 99 cents adds up to where if you have a single person spending $200 to $300 a month on Candy Crush, you can imagine what that game developer as a whole is making annually just by giving the game away for free and then charging for the extra lives or charging for the extra spend. And that in and of itself, you know, and it makes sense too, because now we don't have hard copies of games. You know, you and I are both a generation. We would show up at GameStop or whatever your local game store was at midnight on a Tuesday to get Halo OSBs when it came out, or get Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 when it came out, or get World at War the night it came out. We pay the extra money to get the canteen, or in the case of Modern Warfare, the night vision goggles. Well, that handheld side of it's gone away, and it's all download. And so, hey, download it for free, try it out, and then we'll start nickel and diming you with these weapon packs.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's very much the how the industry works these days. But yeah,
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I definitely take your point about how, you know, media, popular media is often the way in which we do learn about history. And that's, I think, true as well with video games. It was certainly true in the 60s and 70s. That's why there are so many war films that were built by people who went through the Second World War. And that's, you know, there's also a political reason for making those and turning the Allies very much into the good guys and the Nazis into the bad guys. You know, of course, there's good reasons for attracting people to join the military as well through films, and video games are just the latest place where that happens. You know, they are used as well as recruitment tools to the military. They're used to, you know, teach history, but also to teach particular viewpoints on geopolitical situations. So yeah, it's inevitable, I would say.
I can remember going back to the 80s. I can't remember if it was ColecoVision or one of the offset ones, but World War II and video games go back so far. I remember this old game, primarily the black screen and the green crosshair and some crappy voice on like a 2-bit saying B-17 bomber. It was some old World War II bombing game on the first iteration of home video game console. So, sure. You know, military history and technology go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Simon Parkin. The book, The Forbidden Garden, or The Forbidden Garden of Leningrad, depending on where you're buying the book. Pick it up. You will not be disappointed. Like I said, this is more than just a book about botany and Leningrad. You cover so much in this book. You create such a great mental visual history that when you're reading this book, this is a great book. You'll burn through it quick. You won't want to put it down. And you learn so much about what the people in Leningrad and those involved in the whole thing went through. Where can people find you, Simon, on the social media, website, what have you?
Yeah, my website is simonparkin.com, and you can find me on Twitter if you're still on that thing. It's /Simon Parkin.
And as always, if you guys head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com, that's WTSPWWII.com. On the homepage, you'll see Simon's face. You click on that link, it'll go to the page that goes along with this episode, and we'll have links to all his websites and social media as well. Simon, thank you so much. And it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
For myself, Jeff, and Dennis, we'll see you all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.